is your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter, and this is Dr. Diana Wiley. And as I said in my last program with Dr. Mark Schoen, we needed to see female pleasure so that we could demand it for ourselves. Candida Royale, her real name Candace, the godmother of feminist porn, taught us a lot about sex. And we'll talk a little more about her background. But the person who can do it best is my guest, the filmmaker Shona McDonald, who made Candace, a documentary about Candida Royale. Hello, Shona. Welcome
Hi,
to
Diana.
The program. So glad you're here. And
I'm happy to be here.
Good, good. And you are in Vancouver, BC, British Columbia, Canada. And my husband Brian and I traveled to your city to see the premiere of Candace.
Yes,
and that was
amazing.
May 4th. And then the next day we had lunch with you, and after a panel in the morning of the different filmmakers, it was all just quite wonderful. I learned a lot, and I think you did a great job making this documentary. For the listeners, I just wanted to say I knew Candace. She died in September of 2015 of ovarian cancer, but I knew her for over 20 years. She was a good friend of mine. So I thought you did a great job on this documentary. And
Thank you. You've
also made other films, but before we talk about that, what got you interested? Well, maybe it was the Inside Her Sex, the documentary about sexual shame, where she was one of three women. Tell us about your introduction to Candace and what that was about, and the beginnings of your relationship with her.
Well, the project that became Inside Her Sex started off as a documentary. Documentaries tend to morph over time as things happen. And so that one actually started off, I was curious about candidly talking to women as the end users of pornography. It was something I hadn't heard a lot about. So I was curious about that. And that sort of led me to look at feminist or female-centric porn and ask, is there ethical porn and what does that look like? And so it kind of sent me on a journey. I interviewed a number of erotic filmmakers that were working at that point. That was about 5 years ago. And I traveled I met with Petra Joy and Jennifer Lyon Bell and Anna Spann, and so got in touch with Candace about that, of course. And I did an interview with her in July of 2013 as part of that project. And as we were putting that together, it really started to become clear that it wasn't a project about pornography. What was rising up was sort of the conversation around shame. And because she'd spoken so well to that, I got in touch with her and I asked her if she would be willing to do some more filming with me around that subject. And when I called her, she said, oh, I remember the interview with you too. I was thinking about it, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to help me tell my story. I've been in lots of films and lots of documentaries, but I've always wanted to tell my story in my words. So that was sort of where we started.
And you, there was another, so I saw the premiere in Vancouver, BC, and you had another U.S. premiere in San Francisco at the beginning
last
of
week.
June. And
yeah, we were there on June. We showed last Sunday and then Thursday as well.
So what was interesting to me, because I know a lot of Candace's friends, what was interesting to me is that some of them who were at that premiere had a little trouble with your film because it was on the dark side, their words. Of course, it was even for me, but I knew about her her need to have information about her mother. I knew about that for the last few years of her life. But some of her friends objected because they felt she was such, Candace was such a vibrant, and she was, and a lively person. All of that was absolutely true. But you followed Candace's requests, which was to tell her story about her mother, which is pretty central to a lot of her persona, and because her mother abandoned, and there was more to that than. But anyway, the mother left when Candace was only 18 months old. So she really needed to tell this story.
Yeah, so when we first met up, the first meeting we had after that phone call I just described, she called a private investigator. So it was, once I'd said, yeah, sure, let's work on both of these. Let's do a little bit more for what I'm working on, and then let's start to see what we can do to tell your story. That was one of the first things we did, is she made a phone call to a private investigator that someone had given her the name of, because she didn't know at that point whether her mom was still alive or not. Her mom had her when she, her mom would have been in her mid-80s, so it was possible that she would still be alive. So she didn't have a lot of information. She hadn't, she'd looked for her very briefly years before, but not very comprehensively. So it was, you know, maybe the film, doing the filming inspired the search, and the search inspired the filming in some ways.
Oh, I like the way you put that. And, yeah, you did say that filming Candace made it more real for her. And that, you said that in the panel the morning after the premiere on, well, that would have been the morning of May 5th. And I thought that was such an interesting comment. And I asked you in our pre-interview if you could elaborate on that. And, I think the listeners would like to know that, too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's true. It's a theory. I don't know if she would have done the search if we hadn't started filming. So I don't know if all of your listeners know her, but I can briefly sort of describe. She was in porn films in the 70s and into the early 80s, and then went on ultimately to create a film company where she made erotic, she didn't like to call them porn, she was very clear about that, but erotic films for women and couples.
Yes.
And she made 18 feature-length films. But she was also very, her work came out at a time where she was able to, even if her work didn't go mainstream, the conversation that she wanted to have around the films that she was making, around erotica for women and female sexuality and empowering women, was a mainstream conversation. So she was on a lot of the talk shows at that time and for a number of years. Dr. Ruth and Joan Rivers and Donahue and Tyra. And I mean, she sort of touched the mainstream with her message, I think, which was quite significant at the time, and really became a face for talking about female pleasure.
You know, I was on the Jenny Jones show. Well, Jenny Jones didn't have a long life as a talk show. But I was on with her, and the reason that Candace asked me to come along is that I had been recommending for a number of years, well, ever since really, soon after she launched Femme Productions in 1984. And in fact, I'm just going to read what I wrote, because it's a blurb in the beginning of her book, How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do. So this is what I wrote. For years, I have loaned Candida Royale's enlightening and exhilarating films to clients in search of a reliable orgasm. Now with this book, I have another fine addition to my sexuality library. Candace's sex life is fascinating, and she tells all. You'll want to send her a thank you note after reading How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do. Well, she just, I'm still grieving for her death. She wrote, she inscribed in her book, "For Diana, my sister, and all that's fun and delicious, love, Candace. We had a wonderful friendship, and I miss her. I think she contributed so much to female sexuality and pleasure, and her films when they came out, and I would loan the films or tell the clients to go get them. It made such a difference, and I would say, watch her film, stop it every now and then, or at the end, talk to each other about what it, how it inspired you or did not. And so her films really got people talking, and of course that's a big problem with the sex lives of so many people. They don't communicate very well.
Right.
So it was, she made such a difference. The feminist porn, you even have in your documentary when she was asked to speak in front of, was it the Senate or the Congress,
mm-hmm.
Of the United States?
Well, that was in the 80s when Reagan was trying to restrict cable pornography on cable. And so she made a film called Revelations, which was quite a political film about restriction and shutting down. And so, yes, she spoke out about that quite significantly. She did consider herself, and I think was, quite a political person and managed to find a place for her voice politically around the things that
she
were important to her.
Yes, she did, and she was so articulate in the... Well, I'm going to guess the early 90s, maybe the late 80s. I went with her to the American Psychiatric Association meeting. So there were all these psychiatrists there, and they were just enthralled, transfixed with what Candace said. I mean, you know, she really, apparently a lot of her work is now at Harvard, but after her death.
Yeah, but, there's a woman named Jane Kaminsky who's been researching her, I believe.
Yeah, say more. Because I'll finish up the story. This was in San Francisco, so all these psychiatrists were there. I don't remember that any of them were women at the time. And she was talking about her films and the pluses for couples to be able to watch them and talk about female pleasure, because that was her focus.
Yeah.
And Helen Singer was the speaker. Kaplan, Helen Singer Kaplan was a speaker in addition to Candace, and she revolutionized sex therapy. And she died also of cancer a little bit after that. But it was a really an amazing sort of afternoon with the APA and Candace and Dr. Helen Fisher Kaplan, Fisher or Fisher Kaplan. It was just phenomenal, and the psychiatrist could not believe that a female, well, I'm assuming here, that a female filmmaker could do this quote feminist porn. Of course, Candace did not like the word porn in the beginning. I think she came around to it.
She acknowledged that there was nothing else to call it, that really sort of gave the message, mm-hmm. in our linguistic parameters that we have, that really allowed people to understand what she was doing. But I don't know if she ever liked it, but I think she accepted it.
She finally did, I think. Let's tell the listeners how she got into porn in the first place. With her own adult films.
Yeah, what she says, the story that she tells was that she had moved to San Francisco. She'd left quite a tumultuous home life. Obviously, her mom had been gone her whole life, and she'd sort of bounced back and forth between her father's house and her grandmother's house and a couple of foster homes, and eventually her father settled down with his stepmother. So she left in her late teens and moved to San Francisco, and I think got swept up in a drug culture there and an art culture, and needed money. And so it sounds like she said she had a boyfriend who you went to the set of a movie and started to do the movies, and so she went out of curiosity and thought, this isn't so bad. I've talked to a couple of her other friends since who have said that they were doing it or had dabbled in it. So it sounds like there was a curiosity in the circles that she was traveling with, and also the ability to make really good money at the time to support the art habit or the drugs or whatever was going on. And she was, you know, she was stunning. The camera loved her. She looked beautiful on camera, and I think she liked the acting and the performing and the and being seen. And so she did it for a number of years, and was quite in demand.
You know, I just now had this thought. She liked being seen. She liked the attention because it was so absent in her childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Her mother had left. Her father, the jazz musician, was not the most balanced man.
Nope.
And, yeah. And so this was a chance for her to be noticed. And, you know, women especially, but also men, they like to feel acknowledged and noticed.
Yeah.
And get some attention. It's really important for our self-esteem and our sexual well-being. I mean, I often counsel my clients, my couples who are having sexual problems, to pay attention and really listen. Once they can learn how to communicate about sex, and Candace's films helped a lot of couples do that, as I alluded to earlier. But, yeah, that communication is key, but Candace was wanting attention and got it, and she was beautiful and articulate, and she made that transition into the more academic area of with speaking at colleges and universities and in front of the APA and so on.
She also had a lot of interests and was good at many things. So she danced when she was a child. She liked to sing. She had a lovely voice.
Yeah.
She had studied fashion design for a while. So she mm-hmm. sort of had a vast interest, and I think the film work allowed her to show some of those talents.
Yes, and well, at some of our conferences, ASECT, which stands for, and she belonged to ASECT, she got some recognition for her one of her early films, Four Daughters, Three Daughters, as you may know, and you do know, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and so Quad S is another sex conference that we go to get CEs, continuing education, and I could remember a few times just dancing with and sometimes just observing Candace dance. She was a wonderful dancer, and she was a wonderful jazz singer. I mean, she really, as you said, she had a lot of talents.
Yeah.
And the fashion design came out with just the way she dressed.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, she always looked put together.
Yeah, she did. So, but with when she approached you, she wanted you to do what? We touched on this earlier, but just let's break it down in terms of what she really wanted you to do as a filmmaker.
Candace and I were both strong-willed women, and she was a director and an editor and a filmmaker herself. So there was always a dance around how best to tell it. She hadn't made documentaries, I had. So And we struggled to get money. So there were limitations around. If we'd had all the money in the world, I think we would have, you know, gotten quite grand. I think that we both imagined from the get-go probably a larger film than I ended up making. I mean, I remember at one point thinking, oh, it would be amazing to rent a theater and put her films up in the theater and film that and see her, like, you know, to get quite experimental and cinematic with it. But we didn't have the funds to do that. But at the core, she felt like other people had some control over her story. So she had, you know, people would ask her to be in films as I had and share pieces of her story, but those weren't about her. Those were her contributing to a different narrative. And so I think she wanted to control the narrative to some extent. The irony is that I did my best to let her tell her story in her own words, but ultimately unless you can just do it yourself and do everything yourself, you are at the mercy of other people. And that became me in the end to finish that narrative for her. But I did what I could. She didn't ask for other people to be in her film. There were subjects that she didn't cover in our time together that I was able to piece together from other things to make it a little bit more inclusive and broader. But I know there's a story that she tells in the film about a situation in San Francisco. And I knew, unfortunately, when we filmed it, the audio was poor, but I know it's the only time she ever told that story on film. So there were things that she saved up in the hopes of making a film about her. And so one of the challenges in that was there was the story of her mother, there was the story of her cancer, and then there was the story of her career. And unfortunately, we live in a time that the story of her cancer, the story of her mother, isn't as strong without the story of her career. So it was really weaving all the threads together that became a bit of a challenge.
You did it very well, Shauna. My goodness. As somebody who loved her and had a deep friendship with her, it was very hard to see her at the end of her life. The last time I saw her in person was when I visited her in her home in Long Island in 2011.
Right.
We continued to, in fact, she was on my show talking about sex and cancer and other things even before that in 2013. She died in 2015. But seeing her in 2011, being with her, she hadn't, the cancer was certainly there, but she hadn't had as much chemo where she lost her hair when I saw her. In fact, she looked thin, but and she'd cut her hair, but she still was not ravaged by the cancer.
Yeah.
And it was very hard for me to see that in your documentary. But I loved seeing that none of her cognition was affected. She was very clear about what she wanted and needed, and also some sadness and maybe some bitterness about her mother not having ever tried to reach out to her. Can you talk a little bit about that? The mother.
Yeah,
factor.
I mean, she thought it was really unfair that she was dying. She didn't want to die. She had lots of things she wanted to achieve. She was only in her early 60s. She was in her late 50s when she was diagnosed in 2010. And so it felt unfair to her. There were a lot of things she wanted to achieve. She had a book she wanted to write and more films she wanted to make. I mean, she really was very energetic, even when she was sick.
Yes.
And so, it's hard to say, and I don't even know if she really went up and down in the time we spent together about how she felt about her mother. There were times that she was, as we learned things, I think we've given it away that her mom did pass away in the early 90s, and And yeah, I never had been in touch, and that was hard for Candace. Part of the reason she felt like she hadn't reached out to her mom was maybe that her mom would be a bit ashamed of her because she'd been in porn movies. So there, I think it was a very, very complicated thing to try and, what happens when a mom leaves and you never see that mom again? And so as she found out pieces about her, sometimes she was sympathetic. Sometimes she was happy to learn that at the end of her mom's life, her mom seemed to have been happy, that she was angry at her mom in the film and in life. But Candace connects with a brother that she hadn't seen in 60 years, a brother older, half-brother older than her, and learns that he'd stayed with their mom. And so the things that he's able to impart in the stories he's able to tell sort of shift her perspective again. So with both of her parents, it felt like a bit of a roller coaster of how she felt it, about them at different times during our process of discovery.
I was especially, as was my husband Brian, especially touched by the scenes in your documentary with her half-brother. The joy in their seeing each other for the first time was there. And they were so glad to have each other in their respective lives again. It was just palatable. Did I say that word right? It really was amazing. And he was quite articulate in your film.
Yeah, he is. I mean, you know, it's interesting because when he walks in and they meet each other for the first time, that's the first time I met him as well. So we were waiting for him to come. I'd had some contact with him. He knew we were filming. But it is where Candace wanted to tell her story. There are people who come along when you're filming a story who aren't used to being on camera. And he was really gracious and really trusting of that story, and he's seen the film and is happy with the film from what he's said to me, so that's good. Candace's sister has also seen the film and is happy with the film. So that, you know, in her absence, that felt important to me. It felt important for me.
Absolutely. And speaking of the sister, I met the sister before I moved to Seattle a little over 10 years ago. I lived in Century City in Los Angeles, and Candace was often my house guest. I had room for her, and it was very nice, and I met her sister. And what I'm pulling out of her file, because I've saved her emails and her write-ups and so on. So this was July 29th, 2009, and what she writes to me is, I couldn't be more prepared for the challenges that lay ahead than I am after spending 2 loving weeks with my sister. I arrived there, so now she's talking about visiting her sister in California. I arrived there spent and sad and exhausted, and I leave feeling like I've been home and loved and nurtured. She says her sister's name, Cynthia, and I are so very fortunate to have each other. It was relaxing, fun, restful, and I could just be myself. I think she often felt that in my presence. And because I was so accepting. I had a very different history from hers. Mine was secure and happy and parents who loved me and very different, but we connected, and I unconditionally loved her, and I think it was true in reverse. And even as I say that, I'm just realizing how much I still miss her. I'm so glad you made the documentary that you did of Candace. It was, you know, the night I was there with Brian at the premiere, and I mentioned this when the microphone came to me in the after discussions with you and with you, the filmmaker, I said, yes, I'm wearing a beautiful black skirt, 2 layers, the bottom layer with some chiffon. You know, it's really just lovely. And I wore that with a nice, somewhat diaphanous black top because I wanted to channel Candace. And I think I did. I just really felt her presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel her less since I've completed the film. I certainly felt the weight. Her, you know, there was part of me that really, the challenges of actually making it and completing it, there were times I really just would have liked to have left it on the shelf because it was a lot of work. But I did
feel a lot of work. And then the frustrations of not having the funding that you wanted for it.
Yes.
How do you do it? Shona, how do you do it as a filmmaker? Because a lot of times I bet you do struggle with the money issues, the financing.
I mean, I paid for it. That's how I did it. We ended up doing it. Candace and I had tried to do a Kickstarter in August of 2014, which was unfortunate because, you know, to make a film, it's not uncommon to spend, you know, a low-budget film is $100,000, like low budget, and that's not filmmakers getting paid, that's just covering your costs and hopefully hiring people and travel and that sort of thing. And so I wanted, at that time, I was like, we need all of it or I don't want to do it. I sort of wanted to at least be able to see the path forward. And we weren't able to get all of the funding, and then so you don't get any. So that went away, and then there was someone who contributed a lump sum that at least allowed us to get to St. Louis and hire a sound person there, which was important. I filmed most of it myself. But I paid for my travel and we used my equipment and I worked for hundreds of hours for free. I paid editors at different points when I got really stuck. There were three different contributing editors who helped just move things along, and then it would come back to me and I'd be able to move it forward. So that was a good back and forth. But it's not an ideal way to make a film.
No.
I was recommended to me that I do another fundraising campaign simply to show show film festivals that there was some success and a community behind it. So I did that last year, and I think it was $10,000 Canadian, and so that was successful. So at least it looked successful, and that was able to pay for some of the composing. But even getting a composer, you know, you're looking at almost $10,000. So it's expensive hobby.
Well, as I shared with you, I did send a check, but it was I don't know if it was received or deposited because I never heard when you were doing
the Kickstarter.
Kickstarter.
Yeah. It was, hindsight. It was unfortunate. The thing I regret about that first Kickstarter is how much work it was for her. And that was really sort of several weeks in her last summer of reasonable health because she died about a year later. So it was unfortunate that we spent it doing that. I don't know. These things, they unfold as they do.
But it's well, how generous of you to to pay for it. And I think you have left a very important film as part of Candace's legacy. I mean, people would prefer, including some of her friends who were in some of her films early on, when she was doing porn as an actress. And then I think also as she was a director, there were some of her friends, and they didn't really like it that you had to show so much of the dark side. But that's such an important part of her story. Such an important part.
It is, and it's the time that I spent with her, and it's the stuff. It's the stories that she chose to tell when we were spending time together. So, I don't know. She's not here to weigh in. I don't know what she would think of of where it came to in the end. But they were, there's no narration in the film. It really is, they're her words. They're her stories. They're the things that she talked about and told, which is an unusual way to do a biography in some ways to allow someone. There's not, you know, usually you get people weighing in and saying she did this and she did this. So it's a different intimacy and a different perspective of coming at a film.
But very powerful.
Thank you.
Very, very powerful. As I've already mentioned, I had a lot of personal reactions to it that were really sad. She was such a force.
Yes, she was.
Yeah. And, you know, she was a pioneer, she was an entrepreneur, she was a filmmaker, she was an author. And probably her book, I should have checked this out, I'm sure it's, well, everything's available on Amazon, but How to Tell a Naked Man What to Do, Sex Advice from a Woman Who Knows, I'm sure that it's still available. And I'll, when I
yeah,
write
a few
up
out
this,
there, you
yes.
Can.
What, I'm sorry, what did you say?
There's a few out there. You can get them. When we did the Kickstarter, there were a few people who got them, so I've bought a few to give to those people, and you can also get it for a Kindle. So it is available.
That's great. And it's a wonderful book.
Yeah.
Like, I've made this available to some of my clients who are having problems with erectile dysfunction, and then we go to Sensate Focus and Outer Course. And so, and she and I had talked about this. I think she appreciated my sex therapist point of view. But anyway, she writes, and this is very good. I'm looking at her book now, Outer Course Suggestions. These tips for prolonging outer course can be used on either a man or a woman, unless otherwise directed. So then I'll read a couple of them here. Lick and suck your partner's earlobes. They can be very sensitive. Run your tongue along your lover's neck and gently bite it. Trace your lover's body with your tongue. Massage your lover's inner thighs where they meet his groin. Just brushing his genitals. Squeeze and massage the cheeks of his butt. Oh, that's a nice one. Take massage to new heights by massaging every inch of your lover's body without touching his or her genitals. And that's what Masters and Johnson, who were the great American sex researchers of the late 50s and 60s, they felt that too many people, lovers, were just too much focused on genitals. And so Sensate Focus exercises do all of these outer course things that don't involve intercourse. So intercourse is postponed until the couple can feel that they can be turned on by other things. Hands, feet, face, all of that. I don't think she didn't talk about that. Maybe she did in her first. No, she didn't talk about that, I don't think, in your films.
No.
Right.
No, I'm not sure that she didn't spend a lot of time talking about things that were available. There wasn't a lot of prescriptive stuff in the conversations that we have. A lot of it really was internally focused. She was really exploring her own life in the face of her own death in some ways. I mean, I think those
two
existed. You know, at that point, she'd had cancer on and off for 5 years when we first met and started talking. So, and she was waiting on a new drug trial that she was hopeful about. But I think the awareness of time really sort of had her turn and focus inward.
I agree. My last in-person visit with her, as I said, was 2011. And we went to an event together, and where she was asked to be present, and it was just lovely. And she still looked good, but she was very introspective, more than I had ever seen her before.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that happens when you're facing your end of life. And she did not go gently at the end.
No, she fought. Yeah.
She fought. Well, she was a fighter.
Yes.
She was a fighter. And to get her message across that female pleasure is so important. She was one of the first, and bless her for that.
One of the first, and one of really sort of living what she was talking about, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right? She had a message, and then she was doing the work. And I think there were some concerns. You know, she talks about having a scarlet letter on her and sort of having nothing to lose. But I don't think she wanted to be marginalized or, you know, she really had an interest in the mainstream and being seen as mainstream and participating in, not in the fringes, but as part of mainstream culture. I think that had value for her, from what I can tell.
That's why it was so important to her when ASECT, American Association for Sex Therapists, Counselors, and Therapists, I may have the acronym wrong, but anyway, you get the idea. That's why when they acknowledged her and made her a member, and her film, Three Daughters, was there and was acknowledged as being actually it provided sexual education too. It was explicit. It was erotic, but it provided. So that was very important for her, to, because that was a step toward being more mainstream, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, to be accepted was important as a person and as a intelligent and strong woman. So she had a really interesting journey, and she didn't waver, or she didn't appear to waver. I mean, she had, as you said, she wrote her book. She was also part of a company called Natural Contours, where they had sex toys that she had helped develop. So it really was her whole life, and she was proud of having earned enough and made her way, owned her own house.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was pride for her in having turned a situation around that at one point probably hadn't looked very hopeful.
Yeah. She was proud that she had made her own way, and she should have been, because it was so difficult to break into the field and be mainstream. Yeah, I think eventually she felt that her scarlet letter, in quotes, had diminished, that she had set herself apart.
Yeah.
She was respected as a businesswoman, and she was so beautiful and articulate, really intelligent. That when I first met her, and I think it was at a conference, and she was going out of her way to look more mainstream. She wore her glasses, and she had a really tailored, nice suit on. And the first time I talked to her, I think it was about 1989, and I said, you know, I really appreciate your films, and I have suggested that a number of my clients watch them, and they have really benefited from watching them. And by the way, the Sinclair Institute carries all of her films through Adam and Eve. As far as I know, they're still doing it. I should have maybe checked. But her films, they're available. I think they're available. And so I said that to her, and we gradually became friends. And we were both in Amsterdam in 1991 at the World Congress for Sexology, and she presented there, and so did I, and we had a night out on the town with Zaviera, who was the happy hooker. Remember her?
Yeah.
The Dutch woman, the happy hooker. So I was fascinated with her life, and it was so different from my life. But I also recognized that she was just a wonderful, amazing woman, and we could be friends, and we were very good friends. And I'm so grateful for that. And as I've already said, I'm still grieving her loss. But I'm really glad that you did this movie. And there have been other movies of her that maybe her friends, her other friends who didn't like it so much because they found it too dark.
I don't know how they felt in the end. I haven't heard the final verdict, but certainly
you haven't.
At one point,
okay.
That was a concern. So it is it's a heavy film. It's heavy. It's not all heavy, but it's certainly it's not uplifting at the end for sure.
No, but you did include a bunch of earlier clips of her on all these talk shows. I remember on Jenny Jones when I was sitting next to her, and they went out into the audience, and one of the women, I mean, this is like a long time ago. This is the early 90s. And one of the women said in the audience, "Well, I don't believe a woman has enough self-esteem, if she resorts to this kind of thing." So then I came in as the sex, watching explicit movies, right? And I came in and said, "Well, I don't believe that's true. I believe that anything that helps a woman with her sexual confidence and knowledge about sex is so important. And that sexual confidence spills into overall confidence." And well, then I don't know if that person in the audience believed it or not, but there was actually, this is such an interesting study, small one, but so women who learn to have predictable and maybe even multiple orgasms, if they were unhappy in their work, they changed jobs. And if they were happy in their work, they advanced. So it seems to indicate that women who gained more sexual confidence then in turn gained more overall confidence. I mean, I really believe, as a board-certified sex therapist who's been doing this work for 38 years, that our sexuality is pretty central to who we are. It's core.
Yep.
And so the more knowledge you have, and I bet you feel the same way, the more knowledge you have about sex, it empowers you.
No, absolutely. And the more you're able to have conversations about it, and the more we're able to open it up and talk to our kids about it, I mean, it really cascades. It's a cascading effect of dialogue and transparency and health, I think.
Dialogue and transparency, yes. And health. You know, as an older woman, in this last year, for the first time ever, I had some health, some kind of gut problems, health problems, and I am convinced that my healthy, frequent sex life with my husband helped heal me. I mean, sex is so good for you.
Absolutely.
So good for you. So, bravo to you, Shona, that you, and let's talk about, because I'll put it in my review, so people can look at Inside Her Sex, and that's Candace and two other women talking about shame in sex, which is, well, I know this from my clients too, for many of them.
Yep, three very different stories of women who.
Can you talk a little bit about Inside Her Sex? That was the documentary you made.
That was a film. There's three stories, sort of three women talking about sort of where their sexual shame comes from, and in some ways how they work through it in very different ways. But one, a woman named Samantha, who I think when we were filming was around, in her late 20s, mm-hmm. and she had grown up in the Mormon church, and so sort of looking at the shame that was that she experienced as a child, and the work that she did through her life to come to terms with the impacts of the church and then grow to really find herself. She's transgender, but we don't really, that's not really what the film's about. Although I was spending time with her at a time when she was getting ready for a surgery, I really sort of was more interested in her experience as a woman. The second was a woman named Lady Cheeky, or Elle Chase, and she's an author and a sex educator in LA, and she really hadn't had positive sexual experiences until her 40s. She was in a marriage where there wasn't a lot of sex, and she saw an episode of a TV show that kind of woke her up and sent her on this whole new path. So she's very funny and very charming, and there's lots. And then Candace is the third woman in that story. So it might be women that you don't normally hear from necessarily, or hear their stories when you're hearing about sex. So it's just a conversation starter in some ways around sexual health and looking at shame and how to overcome shame.
And how to overcome it, which is a very difficult thing. And I'm a little bit biased about this because I am a therapist who's worked with a lot of women who've been sexually assaulted and have, I co-led two women's sexuality groups for 7 years when I was in California. And a lot of these women in the beginning are not able to have orgasms because they can't trust the man. Their amygdala, the fear center of their brain, is hardwired to not be able to let go. I mean, it's a big problem, shame. So in terms of just being able to be able to have a happy, joyful, sexual life where you can let go and feel safe and all of that. So the more information that we get out, and you're doing a huge favor to so many women by producing and directing and paying for these films.
Well, that one I didn't pay for.
Okay, good. I'm glad to hear that. Because I think you're just a remarkable woman, and I'm so happy that I get to know you and some other people through my radio show with Progressive Radio Network. But even before that, I'm blessed. I'm really blessed because I've been in the field a long time. I know a lot of the people. And then I've had friendships with some people that are kind of on the outside for a lot of people. They're on the outside of the mainstream, right?
Yep.
So, well, Progressive Radio Network likes to stop at a couple of minutes before the top of the hour. So is there any final thing? I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, Shona, but is there any final thing that you'd like to say? Takeaways for the listeners?
I think an interesting... Someone asked me, and it really stuck with me, and I mentioned it to you when we were talking earlier, is that someone had asked me whether I thought that the conversation that Candace was having 20 and 30 years ago was still a valid conversation in this hashtag Me Too era. And I said, I really think it is. In fact, I think it's, you can take some of the arguments that she had and some of the words that she said, or take some of her appearances and play them now, and I think it's still relevant because I'm not sure that we've progressed very far I think that that her voice is still relevant and a conversation that we can carry on today.
So glad I got you to do that. Say those final words. The program has ended. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Diana.
We'll be in touch.
Okay.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Okay, bye.
Nel labirinto di un amaro autore. My